be human. Without them, I would never have reordered my priorities and reoriented my own life. I soon began working less and spending more time with the people in my life. I stopped trying to quantify the impact of each action, who I took meetings with, who I wrote back to, who I spent time with, and instead aimed to treat all those around me equally. This shift in the way I treated others wasn't just beneficial to them. It filled me with a sense of wholeness, satisfaction, and calm that the hollow accomplishments of my career never could. The reality is that it will not be long until AI algorithms can perform many of the diagnostic functions of medical professionals. Those algorithms will pinpoint illness and prescribe treatments more effectively than any single human can. In some cases, doctors will use these equations as a tool. In some cases, the algorithms may replace the doctor entirely. But the truth is, there exists no algorithm that could replace the role of my family in my healing process. What they shared with me is far simpler, and yet so much more profound than anything AI will ever produce. For all of AI's astounding capabilities, the one thing that only humans can provide turns out to also be exactly what is most needed in our lives. Love. It's that moment when we see our newborn babies, the feeling of love at first sight, the warm feeling from friends who listen to us empathetically, or the feeling of self-actualization when we help someone in need. We are far from understanding the human heart, let alone replicating it, but we do know that humans are uniquely able to love and be loved, that humans want to love and be loved, and that loving and being loved are what makes our lives worthwhile. This is the synthesis on which I believe we must build our shared future, on AI's ability to think, but coupled with human beings' ability to love. If we can create this synergy, it will let us harness the undeniable power of artificial intelligence to generate prosperity while also embracing our essential humanity. This isn't something that will come naturally. Building this future for ourselves, as people, countries, and a global community, will require that we reimagine and reorganize our societies from the ground up. It will take social unity, creative policies, and human empathy, but if achieved, it could turn a moment of outright crisis into an unparalleled opportunity. Never has the potential for human flourishing been higher, or the stakes of failure greater. 8. A Blueprint for Human Coexistence with AI. While I was undergoing chemotherapy for my cancer in Taiwan, an old friend of mine who is a serial entrepreneur came to me with a problem at his latest startup. He had already founded and sold off several successful consumer technology companies, but as he grew older, he wanted to do something more meaningful. That is, he wanted to build a product that would serve the people that technology startups had often ignored. Both my friend and I were entering the age at which our parents needed more help going about their daily lives, and he decided to design a product that would make life easier for the elderly. What he came up with was a large touchscreen mounted on a stand that could be placed next to an elderly person's bed. On the screen were a few simple and practical apps connected to services that elderly people could use. Ordering food delivery, playing their favorite soap operas on the TV, calling their doctor, and more. Older people often struggle to navigate the complexities of the internet or to manipulate the small buttons of a smartphone. So my friend made that as simple as possible. All the apps required just a couple of clicks, and he even included a button that let the elderly users directly call up a customer service agent to guide them through using their device. It sounded like a wonderful product, one that would have a real market right now. Sadly, there are many adult children in China and elsewhere who are too busy with work to devote time to taking care of their aging parents. They may experience a sense of guilt about the importance of filial piety, but when it comes down to it, they just don't feel they can find the time to care for their parents in an adequate way. The touchscreen would make for a nice substitute. But after deploying a trial version of his product, my friend discovered he had a problem. Of all the functions available on the device, the one that received by far the most use wasn't the food delivery, TV controls, or doctor's consultation. It was the customer service button. The company's customer service representatives found themselves overwhelmed by a flood of incoming calls from the elderly. What was going on here?
My friend had made the device as simple as possible to use. Were his users still unable to navigate the one-click process on screen?
Not at all. After consulting with the customer service representatives, he found that people weren't calling in because they couldn't navigate the device. They were calling simply because they were lonely and wanted someone to talk to. Many of the elderly users had children who worked to ensure that all of their material needs were met, meals were delivered, doctor's appointments were arranged, and prescriptions were picked up. But once those material needs were taken care of, what these people wanted more than anything was true human contact, another person to trade stories with and relate to. My friend relayed this problem to me just as I was waking up to my own realizations about the centrality of love to the human experience. If he had come to me just a few years earlier, I likely would have recommended some technical fix, maybe something like an AI chatbot that could simulate a basic conversation well enough to fool the human on the other end. But as I recovered from my illness and awakened to the looming AI crises of jobs and meaning, I began to see things differently. In that touchscreen device and that unmet desire for human contact, I saw the first sketches of a blueprint for coexistence between people and artificial intelligence. Yes, intelligent machines will increasingly be able to do our jobs and meet our material needs, disrupting industries and displacing workers in the process, but there remains one thing that only human beings are able to create and share with one another. Love. With all of the advances in machine learning, the truth remains that we are still nowhere near creating AI machines that feel any emotions at all. Can you imagine the elation that comes from beating a world champion at the game you've devoted your whole life to mastering? AlphaGo did just that, but it took no pleasure in its success, felt no happiness from winning, and had no desire to hug a loved one after its victory. Despite what science fiction films like Her, in which a man and his artificially intelligent computer operating system fall in love, portray, AI has no ability nor desire to love or be loved. The actress Scarlett Johansson may have been able to convince you otherwise in that film, but only because she is a human being who drew on her experience of love to create and communicate those feelings to you. Imagine a situation in which you informed a smart machine that you were going to pull its plug, and then changed your mind and gave it a reprieve. The machine would not change its outlook on life or vow to spend more time with its fellow machines. It would not grow emotionally or discover the value in loving and serving others. It is in this uniquely human potential for growth, compassion, and love where I see hope. I firmly believe we must forge a new synergy between artificial intelligence and the human heart, and look for ways to use the forthcoming material abundance generated by artificial intelligence to foster love and compassion in our societies. If we can do these things, I believe there is a path toward a future of both economic prosperity and spiritual flourishing. Navigating that path will be tricky, but if we are able to unite behind this common goal, I believe humans will not just survive in the age of AI. We will thrive like never before. A Trial by Fire and the New Social Contract. The challenges before us remain immense. As I outlined in Chapter 6, within 15 years, I predict that we will technically be able to automate 40 to 50% of all jobs in the United States. That does not mean all of those jobs will disappear overnight. But if the markets are left to their own devices, we will begin to see massive pressure on working people. China and other developing countries may differ slightly in the timing of those impacts, lagging or leading in job losses depending on the structures of their economies. But the overarching trend remains the same: rising unemployment and widening inequality. Techno-optimists will point to history, citing the Industrial Revolution and the 19th century textile industry as proof that things always work out for the best. But as we've seen, this argument stands on increasingly shaky ground. The coming scale, pace, and skill bias of the AI revolution mean that we face a new and historically unique challenge. Even if the most dire predictions of unemployment do not materialize, AI will take the growing wealth inequality of the internet age and accelerate it tremendously. We are already witnessing the way that stagnant wages and growing inequality can lead to political instability and even violence. As AI rolls out across our economies and societies, we risk aggravating and quickening these trends. Labor markets have a way of balancing themselves out in the long run, but getting to that promised long run requires we first pass through a trial by fire of job losses and growing inequality that threaten to derail the process. Meeting these challenges means we cannot afford to passively react. We must proactively seize the opportunity that the material wealth of AI will grant us and use it to reconstruct our economies and rewrite our social contracts. The epiphanies that emerged from my experience with cancer were deeply personal, but I believe they also gave me a new clarity and vision for how we can approach these problems together. Building societies that thrive in the age of AI will require substantial changes to our economy, but also a shift in culture and values. Centuries of living within the industrial economy have conditioned many of us to believe that our primary role in society, and even our identity, is found in productive, wage-earning work. Take that away, and you have broken one of the strongest bonds between a person and his or her community. As we transition from the industrial age to the AI age, we will need to move away from a mindset that equates work with life or treats humans as variables in a grand productivity optimization algorithm. Instead, we must move toward a new culture that values human love, service, and compassion more than ever before. No economic or social policy can brute force a change in our hearts. But in choosing different policies, we can reward different behaviors and start to nudge our culture in different directions. We can choose a purely technocratic approach, one that sees each of us as a set of financial and material needs to be satisfied, and simply transfer enough cash to all people so that they don't starve or go homeless. In fact, this notion of a universal basic income seems to be becoming more and more popular these days. But in making that choice, I believe we would both devalue our own humanity and miss out on an unparalleled opportunity. Instead, I want to lay out proposals for how we can use the economic bounty created by AI to double down on what makes us human. Doing this will require rewriting our fundamental social contracts and restructuring economic incentives to reward socially productive activities in the same way that the industrial economy rewarded economically productive activities. This won't be easy. It will need a multifaceted, all-hands-on-deck approach to economic and social transformation. That approach will rely on input from all corners of society and must be based on constant exploration and bold experimentation. Even with our best efforts, there remains no guarantee of a smooth transition. But both the cost of failure and the potential rewards of success are too great not to try. Let's begin that process. First, I want to examine three of the most popular policy suggestions for adapting to the AI economy, many of them emanating from Silicon Valley. These three are largely technical fixes, tweaks to policy and business models that seek to smooth the transition but do not actually shift the culture. After examining the uses and weaknesses of these technical fixes, I propose three analogous changes that I believe will both alleviate the jobs issues while also pushing us toward a deeper social evolution. Instead of just implementing mere technical fixes, these constitute new approaches to job creation within the private sector, affecting investing and government policy. These approaches take as their goal not just keeping humans one step ahead of AI automation, but actually opening new avenues to increased prosperity and human flourishing. Together, I believe they lay the groundwork for a new social contract that uses AI to build a more humanistic world. The Chinese perspective on AI and jobs. Before diving into the technical fixes proposed by Silicon Valley, let's first look at how this conversation is unfolding in China. To date, China's tech elite have said very little about the possible negative impact of AI on jobs. Personally, I don't believe this silence is due to any desire to hide the dark truth from the masses. I think they genuinely believe there is nothing to fear in the jobs impact of AI advances. In this sense, China's tech elites are aligned with the techno-optimistic American economists who believe that, in the long run, technology always leads to more jobs and greater prosperity for all. Why does a Chinese entrepreneur believe in that with such conviction? For the past 40 years, Chinese people have watched as their country's technological progress acted as the rising tide that lifted all boats. The Chinese government has long emphasized technological advances as key to China's economic development, and that model has proved highly successful in recent decades, moving China from a predominantly agricultural society to an industrial juggernaut and now an innovation powerhouse. Inequality has certainly increased over this same period of time, but those downsides have paled in comparison to the broad-based improvement in livelihoods. It makes a stark contrast to the stagnation and decline felt in many segments of American society, part of the great decoupling between productivity and wages we explored in previous chapters. It also helps explain why Chinese technologists appear unconcerned with the potential jobs impact of their innovations. Even among the Chinese entrepreneurs who do foresee a negative AI impact, there is a pervasive sense that the Chinese government will take care of all the displaced workers. This idea isn't without basis. During the 1990s, China undertook a series of wrenching reforms to its bloated state-owned companies, shedding millions of workers from government payrolls. But despite the massive labor market disruptions, the strength of the national economy and a far-reaching government effort to help workers manage the transition combined to successfully transform the economy without widespread unemployment. Looking into the AI future, many technologists and policymakers share an unspoken belief that these same mechanisms will help China avoid an AI-induced job crisis. Personally, I believe these predictions are too optimistic, so I am working to raise consciousness in China, as I am in the United States, regarding the momentous employment challenges that await us in the age of AI. It is important that Chinese entrepreneurs, technologists, and policymakers take these challenges seriously and begin laying the groundwork for creative solutions. But the cultural mentality described above, one that is reinforced by four decades of growing prosperity, means that we see little discussion of the crisis in China and even less in the way of proposed solutions. To engage with that conversation, we must turn again to Silicon Valley. The three R's: reduce, retrain, and redistribute. Many of the proposed technical solutions for AI-induced job losses coming out of Silicon Valley fall into three buckets: retraining workers, reducing work hours, or redistributing income. Each of these approaches aims to augment a different variable within the labor markets, skills, time, compensation, and also embodies different assumption about the speed and severity of job losses. Those advocating the retraining of workers tend to believe that AI will slowly shift what skills are in demand, but if workers can adapt their abilities and training, then there will be no decrease in the need for labor. Those advocates of reducing work hours believe that AI will reduce the demand for human labor and feel that this impact could be absorbed by moving to a 3 or 4 day work week, spreading the jobs that do remain over more workers. The redistribution camp tends to be the most dire in their predictions of AI-induced job losses. Many of them predict that as AI advances, it will so thoroughly displace or dislodge workers that no amount of training or tweaking hours will be sufficient. Instead, we will have to adopt more radical redistribution schemes to support unemployed workers and spread the wealth created by AI. Next, I will take a closer look at the value and pitfalls of each of these approaches. Advocates of job retraining often point to two related trends as crucial for creating an AI-ready workforce: online education and lifelong learning. They believe that with the proliferation of online education platforms, both free and paid, displaced workers will have unprecedented access to training materials and instruction for new jobs. These platforms, video streaming sites, online coding academies, and so on, will give workers the tools they need to become lifelong learners, constantly updating their skills and moving into new professions that are not yet subject to automation. In this envisioned world of fluid retraining, unemployed insurance brokers can use online education platforms like Coursera to become software programmers. And when that job becomes automated, they can use those same tools to retrain for a new position that remains out of reach for AI, perhaps as an algorithm engineer or as a psychologist. Lifelong learning via online platforms is a nice idea, and I believe retraining workers will be an important piece of the puzzle. It can particularly help those individuals within the bottom right quadrant of our risk of replacement charts from Chapter 6, the slow creep zone, stay ahead of AI's ability to think creatively or work in unstructured environments. I also like that this method can give these workers a sense of personal accomplishment and agency in their own lives. But given the depth and breadth of AI's impact on jobs, I fear this approach will be far from enough to solve the problem. As AI steadily conquers new professions, workers will be forced to change occupations every few years, rapidly trying to acquire skills that it took others an entire lifetime to build up. Uncertainty over the pace and path of automation makes things even more difficult. Even AI experts have difficulty predicting exactly which jobs will be subject to automation in the coming years. Can we really expect a typical worker choosing a retraining program to accurately predict which jobs will be safe a few years from now? I fear workers will find themselves in a state of constant retreat, like animals fleeing relentlessly rising floodwaters, anxiously hopping from one rock to another in search of higher ground. Retraining will help many people find their place in the AI economy, and we must experiment with ways to scale this up and make it widely available. But I believe we cannot count on this haphazard approach to address the macro-level disruptions that will sweep over labor markets. To be clear, I do believe that education is the best long-term solution to the AI-related employment problems we will face. The previous millennia of progress have demonstrated human beings' incredible ability both to innovate technically and to adapt to those innovations by training ourselves for new kinds of work. But the scale and speed of the coming changes from AI will not give us the luxury of simply relying on educational improvements to help us keep pace with the changing demands of our own inventions. Recognition of the scale of these disruptions has led people like Google co-founder Larry Page to advocate a more radical proposition. Let's move to a 4-day work week, or have multiple people share the same job. In one version of this proposal, a single full-time job could be split into several part-time jobs, sharing the increasingly scarce resource of jobs across a larger pool of workers. These approaches would likely mean reduced take-home pay for most workers, but these changes could at least help people avoid outright unemployment. Some creative approaches to work sharing have already been implemented. Following the 2008 financial crisis, several U.S. states implemented work-sharing arrangements to avoid mass layoffs at companies whose business suddenly dried up. Instead of laying off a portion of workers, companies reduced hours for several workers by 20% to 40%. The local government then compensated those workers for a certain percentage of their lost wages, often 50%. This approach worked well in some places, saving employees and companies the disruptions of firing and rehiring at the whim of the business cycle. It also potentially saved local governments money that would have gone to paying full unemployment benefits. Work share arrangements could blunt job losses. particularly for professions in the human veneer quadrant of our risk of replacement graphs, where AI performs the main job task, but only a smaller number of workers are needed to interface with customers. If executed well, these arrangements could act as government subsidies or incentives to keep more workers on the company payroll. But while this approach works well for short-term disruptions, it may lose traction in the face of AI's persistent and non-stop decimation of jobs.
Existing workshare programs only supplement a portion of lost wages, meaning workers still saw a net decline in income.
Workers may accept this knock to their income during a temporary economic crisis, but no one desires stagnation or downward mobility over the long term. Telling a worker making $20,000 a year that they can now work 4 days a week and earn $16,000 is really a non-starter. More creative versions of these programs could correct for this, and I encourage companies and governments to continue experimenting with them. But I fear this kind of approach will be far from sufficient to address the long-term pressures that AI will bring to the labor market. For that, we may have to adopt more radical redistributive measures. The basics of universal basic income. Currently, the most popular of these methods of redistribution is, as mentioned earlier, the universal basic income, UBI. At its core, the idea is simple. Every citizen, or every adult, in a country, receives a regular income stipend from the government, no strings attached. A UBI would differ from traditional welfare or unemployment benefits in that it would be given to everyone and would not be subject to time limits, job search requirements, or any constraints in how it could be spent. An alternate proposal, often called a guaranteed minimum income, GMI, calls for giving the stipend only to the poor, turning it into an income floor below which no one could fall, but without the universality of a UBI. Funding for these programs would come from steep taxes on the winners of the AI revolution, major technology companies, legacy corporations that adapted to leverage AI, and the millionaires, billionaires, and perhaps even trillionaires who cashed in on these companies' success. The size of the stipend given is a matter of debate among proponents. Some people argue for keeping it very small, perhaps just $10,000 per year, so that workers still have a strong incentive to find a real job. Others view the stipend as a full replacement for the lost income of a regular job. In this view, a UBI could become a crucial step toward creating a leisure society, one in which people are fully liberated from the need to work and free to pursue their own passions in life. Discussion of a UBI or GMI in the United States dates back to the 1960s, when it won support from people as varied as Martin Luther King Jr. and Richard Nixon. At the time, advocates saw a GMI as a simple way to end poverty. And in 1970, President Nixon actually came close to passing a bill that would have granted each family enough money to raise itself above the poverty line. But following Nixon's unsuccessful push, discussion of a UBI or GMI largely dropped out of public discourse. That is, until Silicon Valley got excited about it. Recently, the idea has captured the imagination of the Silicon Valley elite, with giants of the industry like the prestigious Silicon Valley startup accelerator Y Combinator President Sam Altman and Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes sponsoring research and funding basic income pilot programs. Whereas GMI was initially crafted as a cure for poverty in normal economic times, Silicon Valley's surging interest in the programs sees them as solutions for widespread technological unemployment due to AI. The bleak predictions of broad unemployment and unrest have put many of the Silicon Valley elite on edge. People who have spent their careers preaching the gospel of disruption appear to have suddenly woken up to the fact that when you disrupt an industry, you also disrupt and displace real human beings within it. Having founded and funded transformative internet companies that also contributed to gaping inequality, this cadre of millionaires and billionaires appear determined to soften the blow in the age of AI. To these proponents, Massive redistribution schemes are potentially all that stand between an AI-driven economy and widespread joblessness and destitution. Job retraining and clever scheduling are hopeless in the face of widespread automation, they argue. Only a guaranteed income will let us avert disaster during the jobs crisis that looms ahead. How exactly a UBI would be implemented remains to be seen. A research organization associated with Y Combinator is currently running one pilot program in Oakland, California, that gives 1,000 families a stipend of $1,000 each month for 3 to 5 years. The research group will track the well-being and activities of those families through regular questionnaires, comparing them with a control group that receives just $50 per month. Many in Silicon Valley see the program through the lens of their own experience as entrepreneurs. They envision the money not only as a kind of broad safety net, but as an investment in the startup of you. Or, as one tech writer put it, VC for the people. In this worldview, a UBI would give unemployed people a little personal angel investment with which they could start a new business or learn a new skill. In his 2017 Harvard commencement speech, Mark Zuckerberg aligned himself with this vision of UBI, arguing that we should explore a UBI so that everyone has a cushion to try new ideas. From my perspective, I can understand why the Silicon Valley elite have become so enamored with the idea of a UBI. It is a simple technical solution to an enormous and complex social problem of their own making. But adopting a UBI would constitute a major change in our social contract, one that we should think through very carefully and most critically. While I support certain guarantees that basic needs will be met, I also believe embracing a UBI as a cure-all for the crisis we face is a mistake and a massive missed opportunity. To understand why, we must truly look at the motivations for the frenzy of interest in UBI and also think hard about what kind of society it may create. Silicon Valley's magic wand mentality. In observing Silicon Valley's surge in interest around UBI, I believe some of that advocacy has emerged from a place of true and genuine concern for those who will be displaced by new technologies. But I worry that there's also a more self-interested component. Silicon Valley entrepreneurs know that their billions in riches and their role in instigating these disruptions make them an obvious target of mob anger if things ever spin out of control. With that fear fresh in their minds, I wonder if this group has begun casting about for a quick fix to problems ahead. The mixed motivations of these people shouldn't lead us to outright dismiss the solutions they put forth. This group, after all, includes some of the most creative businesses and engineering minds in the world today. Silicon Valley's tendency to dream big, experiment, and iterate will all be helpful as we navigate these uncharted waters. But an awareness of these motivations should sharpen our critical engagement with proposals like UBI. We should be aware of the cultural biases that engineers and investors bring with them when tackling a new problem, particularly one with profound social and human dimensions. Most of all, when evaluating these proposed solutions, we must ask what exactly they're trying to achieve. Are they seeking to ensure that this technology genuinely and truly benefits all people across society? Or are they looking only to avert a worst-case scenario of social upheaval? Are they willing to put in the legwork needed to build new institutions, or merely looking for a quick fix that will assuage their own consciences and absolve them of responsibility for the deeper psychological impacts of automation? I fear that many of those in Silicon Valley are firmly in the latter camp. They see UBI as a magic wand that could make disappear the myriad economic, social, and psychological downsides of their exploits in the AI age. UBI is the epitome of the light approach to problem solving so popular in the Valley. Stick to the purely digital sphere and avoid the messy details of taking action in the real world. It tends to envision that all problems can be solved through a tweaking of incentives or a shuffling of money between digital bank accounts. Best of all, it doesn't place any further burden on researchers to think critically about the societal impacts of the technologies they build. As long as everyone gets that monthly dose of UBI, all is well. The tech elite can go on doing exactly what they planned to do in the first place, building innovative companies and reaping massive financial rewards. Sure, higher taxes required to fund a UBI will cut into those profits to a certain degree, but the vast majority of the financial benefits from AI will still accrue to this elite group. Seen in this matter, UBI isn't a constructive solution that leverages AI to build a better world. It's a painkiller, something to numb and sedate the people who have been hurt by the adoption of AI. And that numbing effect goes both ways. Not only does it ease the pain for those displaced by technology, it also assuages the conscience of those doing the displacing. As I've said before, some form of guaranteed income may be necessary to put an economic floor under everyone in society. But if we allow this to be the end game, we miss out on the great opportunity presented to us by this technology. Instead of simply falling back on a painkiller like a UBI, we must proactively seek and find ways of utilizing AI to double down on that which separates us from machines. Love. Admittedly, this won't be easy. It will require creative and different approaches. Executing on these approaches will take a lot of legwork and heavy solutions, reaching beyond the digital sphere and into the not-so-neat details of the real world. But if we commit to doing the hard work now, I believe we have a shot at not just avoiding disaster, but of cultivating the same humanistic values that I rediscovered during my own encounter with mortality. Market symbiosis, optimization tasks, and human touch. The private sector is leading the AI revolution, and in my mind, it must also take the lead in creating the new, more humanistic jobs that power it. Some of these will emerge through the natural functioning of the free market, while others will require conscious efforts by those motivated to make a difference. Many of the jobs created by the free market will grow out of a natural symbiosis between humans and machines. While AI handles the routine optimization tasks, human beings will bring the personal, creative, and compassionate touch. This will involve the redefinition of existing occupations or the creation of entirely new professions in which people team up with machines to deliver services that are both highly efficient and eminently human. In the risk of replacement graphs from Chapter 6, we expect to see the upper left quadrant, human veneer, offer the greatest opportunity for human-AI symbiosis. AI will do the analytical thinking while humans will wrap that analysis in warmth and compassion. In that same chart, the two quadrants on the right-hand side of the graph, slow creep and safe zone, also provide opportunities for AI tools to enhance creativity or decision-making, though over time the two left-side AI-centric circles will grow toward the right as AI improves. A clear example of human-AI symbiosis for the upper left-hand human veneer quadrant can be found in the field of medicine. I have little doubt that AI algorithms will eventually far surpass human doctors in their ability to diagnose disease and recommend treatments. Legacy institutions, medical schools, professional associations, and hospitals may slow down the adoption of these diagnostic tools, using them only in narrow fields or strictly as reference tools. But in a matter of a few decades, I'm confident that the accuracy and efficiency gains will be so great that AI-driven diagnoses will take over eventually. One response to this would be to get rid of doctors entirely, replacing them with machines that take in symptoms and spit out diagnoses. But patients don't want to be treated by a machine, a black box of medical knowledge that delivers a cold pronouncement. You have fourth stage lymphoma and a 70% likelihood of dying within 5 years. Instead, patients will desire, and I believe the market will create, a more humanistic approach to medicine. Traditional doctors could instead evolve into a new profession, one that I'll call a compassionate caregiver. These medical professionals would combine the skills of a nurse, medical technician, social worker, and even psychologist. Compassionate caregivers would be trained not just in operating and understanding the diagnostic tools, but also in communicating with patients, consoling them in times of trauma, and emotionally supporting them throughout their treatment. Instead of simply informing patients of their objectively optimized chances of survival, they could share encouraging stories, saying, "Kai Fu had the same lymphoma as you, and he survived, so I believe you can too." These compassionate caregivers wouldn't compete with machines in their ability to memorize facts or optimize treatment regimens. In the long run, that's a losing battle. Compassionate caregivers would be well-trained, but in activities requiring more emotional intelligence, not as mere vessels for the canon of medical knowledge. They would form a perfect complement to the machine, giving patients unparalleled accuracy in their diagnoses, as well as the human touch that is so often missing from our hospitals today. In this human-machine symbiosis created by the free market, we would inch our society ahead in a direction of being a little kinder and a little more loving. Best of all, the emergence of compassionate caregivers would dramatically increase both the number of jobs and the total amount of medical care given. Today, the scarcity of trained doctors drives up the cost of health care and drives down the amount of quality care delivered around the world. Under current conditions of supply and demand, it's simply not cost-feasible to increase the number of doctors. As a result, we strictly ration the care they deliver. No one wants to go wait in line for hours just to have a few minutes with a doctor, meaning that most people only go to hospitals when they feel it's absolutely necessary. While compassionate caregivers will be well-trained, they can be drawn from a larger pool of workers than doctors and won't need to undergo the years of rote memorization that is required of doctors today. As a result, society will be able to cost-effectively support far more compassionate caregivers than there are doctors, and we would receive far more and better care. Similar synergies will emerge in many other fields: teaching, law, event planning, and high-end retail. Paralegals at law firms could hand their routine research tasks off to algorithms and instead focus on communicating more with clients and making them feel cared for. AI-powered supermarkets like the Amazon Go store may not need cashiers anymore, so they could greatly update the customer experience by hiring friendly concierges, like the one I described in Chapter 5. For those in professional sectors, it will be imperative that they adopt and learn to leverage AI tools as they arrive. As with any technological revolution, many workers will find the new tools both imperfect in their uses and potentially threatening in their implications. But these tools will only improve with time, and those who seek to compete against AI on its own terms will lose out. In the long run, resistance may be futile, but symbiosis will be rewarded. Finally, the internet-enabled sharing economy will contribute significantly to alleviating job losses and redefining work for the AI age. We'll see more people step out of traditional careers that are being taken over by algorithms, instead using new platforms that apply the Uber model to a variety of services. We see this already in care.com, an online platform for connecting caregivers and customers. And I believe we will see a blossoming of analogous models in education and other fields. Many mass market goods and services will be captured by data and optimized by algorithms, but some of the more piecemeal or personalized work within the sharing economy will remain the exclusive domain of humans. In the past, this type of work was constrained by the bureaucratic costs of running a vertical company that attracted customers, dispatched workers, and kept everyone on the payroll even when there wasn't work to be done. The platformization of these industries dramatically increases their efficiency, increasing total demand and take-home pay for the service workers themselves. Adding AI to the equation, as ride-hailing companies like Didi and Uber have already done, will only further boost efficiency and attract more workers. Beyond the established roles in the sharing economy, I'm confident we will see entirely new service jobs emerge that we can hardly imagine today. Explain to someone in the 1950s what a life coach was, and they'd probably think you were goofy. Likewise, as AI frees up our time, creative entrepreneurs and ordinary people will leverage these platforms to create new kinds of jobs. Perhaps people will hire season changers who redecorate their closets every few months, scenting them with flowers and aromas that match the mood of the season. Or environmentally conscious families will hire home sustainability consultants to meet with the family and explore creative and fun ways for the household to reduce its environmental footprint. But despite all these new possibilities created by profit-seeking businesses, I'm afraid the operations of the free market alone will not be enough to offset the massive job losses and gaping inequality on the horizon. Private companies already create plenty of human-centered service jobs. They just don't pay well. Economic incentives, public policies, and cultural dispositions have meant that many of the most compassion-filled professions existing today often lack job security or basic dignity. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics has found that home health aides and personal care aides are the two fastest-growing professions in the country, with an expected growth of 1.2 million jobs by 2026. But annual income in these professions averages just over $20,000. Other humanistic labors of love, stay-at-home parenting, caring for aging or disabled relatives, aren't even considered a job and receive no formal compensation. These are exactly the kinds of loving and compassionate activities that we should embrace in the AI economy, but the private sector has proven inadequate so far at fostering them. There may come a day when we enjoy such material abundance that economic incentives are no longer needed, but in our present economic and cultural moment, money still talks. Orchestrating a true shift in culture will require not just creating these jobs, but turning them into true careers with respectable pay and greater dignity. Encouraging and rewarding these pro-social activities means going beyond the market symbiosis of the private sector. We will need to re-energize these industries through service sector impact investing and government policies that nudge forward a broader shift in cultural values. Fink's Letter and the New Impact Investing. When a man overseeing $5.7 trillion speaks, the global business community tends to listen. So when BlackRock founder Larry Fink, head of the world's largest asset management company, posted a letter to CEOs demanding greater attention to social impact, it sent shockwaves through corporations around the globe. In the letter, titled A Sense of Purpose, Fink wrote, "We see many governments failing to prepare for the future on issues ranging from retirement and infrastructure to automation and worker retraining. As a result, society increasingly is turning to the private sector and asking that companies respond to broader societal challenges. Society is demanding that companies, both public and private, serve a social purpose. Companies must benefit all of their stakeholders, including shareholders, employees, customers, and the communities in which they operate." Fink's letter dropped just days before the 2018 World Economic Forum, an annual gathering of the global financial elite in Davos, Switzerland. I was attending the forum and watched as CEOs anxiously discussed the stern warning from a man whose firm controlled substantial ownership stakes in their companies. Many publicly professed sympathy for Fink's message, but privately declared his emphasis on broader social welfare to be anathema to the logic of private enterprise. Looked at narrowly enough, they're right. Publicly traded companies are in it to win it, bound by fiduciary duties to maximize profits. But in the age of AI, this cold logic of dollars and cents simply can't hold. Blindly pursuing profits without any thought to social impact won't just be morally dubious, it will be downright dangerous. Fink referenced automation and job retraining multiple times in his letter. As an investor with interests spanning the full breadth of the global economy, he sees that dealing with AI-induced displacement is not something that can be left entirely up to free markets. Instead, it is imperative that we reimagine and reinvigorate corporate social responsibility, impact investing, and social entrepreneurship. In the past, these were the kinds of things that business people merely dabbled in when they had time and money to spare. Sure, they think, why not throw some money into a microfinance startup or buy some corporate carbon offsets so we can put out a happy press release touting it? But in the age of AI, we will need to seriously deepen our commitment to and broaden our definition of these activities. Whereas these have previously focused on feel-good philanthropic issues like environmental protection and poverty alleviation, social impact in the age of AI must also take on a new dimension: the creation of large numbers of service jobs for displaced workers. As a venture capital investor, I see a particularly strong role for a new kind of impact investing. I foresee a venture ecosystem emerging that views the creation of humanistic service sector jobs as a good in and of itself. It will steer money into human-focused service projects that can scale up and hire large numbers of people: lactation consultants for postnatal care, trained coaches for youth sports, gatherers of family oral histories, nature guides at national parks, or conversation partners for the elderly. Jobs like these can be meaningful on both a societal and personal level, and many of them have the potential to generate real revenue, not just the 10,000% returns that come from investing in a unicorn technology startup. Kickstarting this ecosystem will require a shift in mentality for VCs who participate. The very idea of venture capital has been built around high risks and exponential returns. When an investor puts money into 10 startups, they know full well that 9 of them most likely will fail. But if that one success story turns into a billion-dollar company, the exponential returns on that one investment make the fund a huge success. Driving those exponential returns are the unique economics of the internet. Digital products can be scaled up infinitely with near zero marginal costs, meaning the most successful companies achieve astronomical profits. Service-focused impact investing, however, will need to be different. It will need to accept linear returns when coupled with meaningful job creation. That's because human-driven service jobs simply cannot achieve these exponential returns on investment. When someone builds a great company around human care work, they cannot digitally replicate these services and blast them out across the globe. Instead, the business must be built piece by piece, worker by worker. The truth is, traditional VCs wouldn't bother with these kinds of linear companies, but these companies will be a key pillar in building an AI economy that creates new jobs and fosters human connections. There will, of course, be failures, and returns will never match pure technology VC funds. But that should be fine with those involved. The ecosystem will likely be staffed by older VC executives who are looking to make a difference, or possibly by younger VC types who are taking a sabbatical or doing pro bono work. They will bring along their keen instincts for picking entrepreneurs and building companies, and will put them to work on these linear service companies. The money behind the funds will likely come from governments looking to efficiently generate new jobs, as well as companies doing corporate social responsibility. Together, these players will create a unique ecosystem that is much more jobs-focused than pure philanthropy, much more impact-focused than pure venture capital. If we can pull together these different strands of socially conscious business, I believe we'll be able to weave a new kind of employment safety net, all while building communities that foster love and compassion. Big changes and big government. And yet, for all the power of the private market and the good intentions of social entrepreneurs, many people will still fall through the cracks. We need look no further than the gaping inequality and destitute poverty in so much of the world today to recognize that markets and moral imperatives are not enough. Orchestrating a fundamental change in economic structures often requires the full force of governmental power. If we hope to write a new social contract for the age of AI, we will need to pull on the levers of public policy. There are some in Silicon Valley who see this as the point where UBI comes into play. Faced with inadequate job growth, the government must provide a blanket guarantee of economic security, a cash transfer that can save displaced workers from destitution, and which will also save the tech elite from having to do anything else about it. The unconditional nature of the transfer fits with the highly individualistic, live-and-let-live libertarianism that undergirds much of Silicon Valley. Who is the government, UBI proponents ask, to tell people how to spend their time? Just give them the money and let them figure it out on their own. It's an approach that matches how the tech elite tend to view society as a whole. Looking outward from Silicon Valley, they often see the world in terms of users rather than citizens, customers rather than members of a community. I have a different vision. I don't want to live in a society divided into technological castes, where the AI elite live in a cloistered world of almost unimaginable wealth, relying on minimal handouts to keep the unemployed masses sedate in their place. I want to create a system that provides for all members of society, but one that also uses the wealth generated by AI to build a society that is more compassionate, loving, and ultimately human. Achieving this outcome will definitely require creative thinking and complex policymaking, but the inspiration driving that process often comes from unlikely places. For me, it began back at Fo Guangshan, the monastery in Taiwan that I discussed in the previous chapter. The Chauffeur CEO. The morning sun had not yet crept over the horizon as I walked across the monastery's massive grounds to see Master Hsing Yun. It was the morning on which I'd been given a chance to have breakfast with the head monk, and I was hustling my way up a hill when a golf cart pulled up alongside me. "Good morning," the man behind the wheel said to me. "Can I offer you a ride?" Not wanting to keep Master Hsing Yun waiting, I accepted and climbed into the cart, telling the driver where I was headed. He was dressed in jeans and a simple long-sleeved shirt with an orange vest over it. He looked to be in his 50s like me, with streaks of gray in his hair. We rode in silence for a few minutes, absorbing the stillness of the landscape and the gentle breeze of cool morning air. As we rounded the hillside, I filled the silence with a bit of small talk. "Do you do this for a living?" I asked. "No," he replied. "I just volunteer here when I can find time outside my job." I noticed that stitched across the left breast of his orange vest was the word "volunteer" in Chinese characters. "Well, what do you do for work?" I asked. "I own an electronics manufacturing company and work as the CEO, but lately I've been spending less time working and more time volunteering. It's really special to see Master Hsing Yun share wisdom with people here. It brings a sense of serenity to help out with that in any way I can." Those words and the calm demeanor with which he spoke them struck me. Electronics manufacturing can be a brutally competitive industry, one with razor-thin margins and unceasing pressure to innovate, upgrade, and optimize operations. Success often comes at the expense of health, with long hours at the factory bleeding into long nights drinking, smoking, and entertaining clients. But the man driving the cart seemed healthy in body and totally at peace as he steered the golf cart up the winding path. He told me about how his weekends volunteering here at Fo Guangshan had become a way to cleanse the burden and stress of his work week. He wasn't yet ready to retire, but the act of serving those who visited Fo Guangshan let him tap into something both simpler and more profound than the machinations of his company. When we reached Master Hsing Yun's quarters, I thanked the driver, and he replied with a nod of his head and a smile. During the breakfast that followed, the wisdom shared by Master Hsing Yun would have a profound impact on how I thought about my work and my life. But the conversation with the volunteer driving the golf cart also stayed with me. At first, I thought his devotion to humbly serving those around him was something unique to the monastery, a function of the power of religious faith to unite and inspire us. But when I returned to Taipei for my medical treatment, I began to notice people wearing those orange volunteer vests all around the city, in the library, at busy traffic intersections, in county offices, and at national parks. They held up stop signs for children crossing the street, told park visitors about the indigenous flora of Taiwan, and guided people through the process of applying for health insurance. Many of the volunteers were elderly people or recently retired. Their pension plans took care of basic necessities, and so they devoted their time to helping others and maintaining solid bonds with their community. As I underwent chemotherapy and began to contemplate the coming crises of the AI age, I often thought of the volunteers. While many individuals these days pontificate about using UBI as an all-purpose social sedative, I saw a certain wisdom in the humble activities of these volunteers and the broader communal culture they were creating.